it gives me great pleasure to introduce Brandon from Chicago.
All right.
Thank you. I'm a two-fisted drinker here. It used to be Manhattan's, now it's just water. My name is Brendan Coyle, and I'm an Irish Catholic from the south side of Chicago. You may wonder, why did I come all the way to speak tonight? I live here half the time. I actually live in Chicago and I work here, but I actually spend more nights here than I do back in Chicago. But Chicago is where I pay taxes from, so that's, as far as the government's concerned, that's home. As I said, I'm an Irish Catholic from the south side. I went to Catholic school for 8 years. I went to the seminary for a couple years. And then I decided I had enough of the church, and that was kind of the end of the church for quite a while. It's interesting. One of the things that I will try and work into this conversation tonight is the difference in my understanding and my relationship with God when I left the seminary and what it's like now. Not just my relationship, but my understanding of God. It says in How It Works, we tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'll start off with what it was like, and there's not really all that much to talk about. I don't have a real interesting, dramatically humorous, or powerful drunkalogue. It's just kind of a drunkalogue. My first real experience with alcohol that I can solidly remember was when I was around 12 or 13 years old. And being the budding genius that I was, when my parents went out, I decided I wanted to try some hard alcohol. And I realized if I just kind of drank a whole bottle, they would notice that this bottle was suddenly empty. So I had the brilliant idea that I would take a little bit from each of the bottles. Now, my parents were not alcoholics, but they did like to party. They didn't party all the time. They had parties at the, you know, the normal party times. And then they would drink and have a good time, and that was the end of it. So we had a very well-stocked liquor cabinet, and I mean very well-stocked. So I got a big tumbler, and I filled it with a little bit of everything I could find in the liquor cabinet. So it had scotch, bourbon, cream de menthe, Southern Comfort, gin, vodka. I mean, there was at least 15 different liquors mixed into this tumbler. And the tumbler was like 12 ounces, maybe 16. And obviously this is not a sipping drink. So I fired that sucker right down. And it took about 30 to 60 seconds before it felt like I got hit in the head with a hot 2x4. I mean, it felt like I got knocked to my knees. And my head was spinning. And then you can imagine what came next. About a minute and a half to 2 minutes later, everything started coming back. I barely made it to the bathroom in time, and that was my first experience with alcohol. That should have told me something, that's probably not the normal way people would tend to drink, but didn't matter to me. I really didn't have much experience with alcohol after that until I was probably in my early 20s, and that's when my drinking career really started taking off. And I've always thought it's interesting, only an alcoholic would think of it as a career. You know, most people think of drinking, but an alcoholic thinks of having a drinking career. And that's, for me, that's what it was. When I finally got in the program a few years later, I thought of myself as a professional drinker. That was what I, if people ask, what did you do, what were you all about? I was an alcoholic, and I was proud of being an alcoholic because that was a profession. I was not some amateur, sloppy drunk. I was a professional drinker, and that was what my life was about. Not too many really interesting, humorous things. The thing I remember most about what I would call my drinking career is towards the last 6 to 8 months, I would throw up every night. And I don't mean just occasionally, I mean every single night, because that was the only way I was going to go to sleep, because I had had enough to drink that if I didn't throw up, the room would kind of swim, the bed would be doing those swirly things, and there was no way I was getting to sleep. But if I threw up, I could at least get back to sleep. And that was every every single night. Many years after I got in the program, fortunately it was many years after I got in the program, I got the flu. And I, you know, the stomach stuff where you start throwing up, and I was throwing up for like three or four times, and I realized I used to do this every night. How did I manage to survive? What the hell possessed me to want to keep doing that to myself? As I said, I viewed myself as a professional alcoholic. My drinking buddy, there was one guy that he and I would drink all the time, and we'd always drink together. And he and I would talk about the four or five, whatever stages there were of alcoholism. I don't know. We were just kind of bullshitting as we went along. And thought about the fact that we were only at the second stage of alcoholism. We hadn't gotten to the third stage, whatever the hell the third stage was. I couldn't tell you anymore. And so until we got to the third stage, it was safe to keep drinking. We were okay. Fortunately, I got to the third stage before I killed myself, and so that's how I got into the program. So that not much to tell. The last thing I remember in terms of my drinking time, and this is when I knew the jig was up, that it was all over, was the lady that is now my wife. We had been living together, and being the childish idiot that I was, we had some kind of spat, and I left. And here I am at 26 years old, back in my bedroom, what I grew up in, with my parents' house. And it's, I can remember it was 10 after 1 in the morning. I can't remember the day of the week, but it was 10 after 1 in the morning. They're asleep. I'm drinking apricot brandy. Not because I like apricot brandy, but because it was the only alcohol left in the house. I had pretty much cleaned everything else out. Now, I may have been an alcoholic, but I had class. I wasn't drinking it out of the bottle or out of some tumbler. I was drinking it out of a special cordial glass, because if you're going to drink brandy, you have to drink it out of the right kind of little glass. And here it is, about 10 after 1 in the morning, and I'm drinking this, and I don't know if you've ever had apricot brandy. If you haven't, don't. It tastes like drinking alcoholic Cairo syrup. It is just pure syrup. And it's just disgusting. But it's got alcohol in it. And I'm looking at this and I'm realizing I can't see continuing life this way. I can't see living this way. And at the same moment, I'm thinking, I can't envision life without alcohol. And I knew I was insane, because there was no way I could hold both of those thoughts in my head at the same time and not be insane. And here's what I thought was going to happen. I thought that eventually I would be driving drunk, I would kill somebody, I would end up in prison, and that was going to be the end of my life. I didn't realize that about 6 weeks later, I was going to find this program and my life was going to change. My wife, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, realized that I thought I had a problem with alcohol. She didn't think I had any problem with alcohol, but she realized that I thought I had. How she didn't think I had a problem with alcohol is beyond me, because at the time I was drinking probably a minimum of half a fifth a day, sometimes closer to a fifth. I had finally gotten to the point where I had to go out to lunch to get a few drinks, and I was getting pretty good at it. In half an hour, I could pound down four Manhattans and get back to the office. And when I make a Manhattan, as I tell people, you fill the glass to the brim with bourbon, you have a moment of silence for the vermouth, and you fire the sucker down. That's how you make a Manhattan. So she decided that since I thought I had a problem with alcohol, she would go check it out. So she went to an Al-Anon meeting. And that was May 1st, 1978. That was the first day in a long time that I didn't pick up a drink. And she came back, and I remember she came back that night, and I was curious. I said, "So what was it like?" And she said, "You're not going to like it." And I said, "Why not?" She said, "Well, it's a spiritual program." Now, she said, "It's a spiritual program." I heard it's religion. And I thought, you're absolutely right, there's no way. That was the first day I didn't pick up a drink. I didn't pick up a drink the whole next week. And I got through that next week just gritting my teeth saying, "This is the, if I want to pick up a drink, that'd be the worst time to pick up a drink. You're not going to pick up a drink." And I got through it on just sheer gritting my teeth guts. Now, those of you who've been around a while realize there are other meetings. I didn't know that. I didn't know anything about AA at the time. And my wife had said, there's an AA meeting at the same time. So I thought, okay, I'll go to that AA meeting. Never dawned on me there might be meetings in between that time. So the following week, I go to the meeting. Now, I'm going into this first AA meeting thinking it's kind of like a Southern revival. You know, people are going to walk in, say they're going to lay hands. I'm saved. Jesus has saved me. That's exactly what I thought AA was about. So I go into this meeting. I haven't been 12-stepped. I don't know a thing about AA. Absolutely nothing, other than it stands for Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I know about AA. And I go in this meeting, and you want to talk about one obnoxious SOB? That was me. I walk in the meeting, and they said, "What are you here for?" And I remember, I can still remember exactly what I said. I said, "I'm looking for peace and serenity." And they said, "Well, you're in the right place. Why don't you sit down?" And they held a first step meeting for me. Now, I've been in many first step meetings since then when we have new people come in. And I've never seen anybody in a first step meeting nearly as obnoxious as I was in my first step meeting. Because I just want to know, what was it about? How do you work it? What happens? How do I do this? What? And they kept telling me, "Don't worry, we'll get to that. We'll get to that." They assigned me a sponsor. He had been sober a year. And off I went. And that's when the story, for me anyway, really gets interesting, because the story of what happened is really what it's all about. I got through the first step pretty well, because I was able to admit I was an alcoholic. Hell, I was proud of the fact that I was an alcoholic. So that was a piece of cake. Powers over alcohol. Yeah, okay, whatever. Okay, that's cool. Then we get to the second step. There's a power greater than myself. Okay, so that's God. Yeah, I know all about God. I can tell you God inside and out, upside down. I learned all the catechism. I could recite the Baltimore Catechism for you. I can tell you all the definitions, all that crap. So, okay, fine, there's a God. Let's move on. So we get to the third step. Turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand. Yeah, sure. Okay, there's a God. He's more powerful than me. Fine. Okay, so now I'm probably 2 or 3 weeks into the program. I'm already through the third step. I'm rolling. Now we get to the fourth step. And the way my sponsor set up doing the fourth step was, and I've used this myself, you schedule the fifth step. Now you got to do the fourth step. Okay, so I've got to do the fourth step, and I can't do the fourth step. I just can't do the fourth step. And then I realize I really can't do the third step. See, because I listened to the words, turn our will and our lives. So I'm supposed to turn my life over to this nasty son of a bitch who runs my life and is just this obnoxious, hairy old guy. And I was thinking, I spent my life up to that point, which I thought was just this incredibly long life, trying to get free to be able to do whatever I wanted. And now you're telling me I'm supposed to turn my life over to somebody else. No, not happening. Just not going to happen. I'm not going to do that. Okay. Now, I've still got this deadline of doing the fifth step, which means I've still got this deadline of doing the fourth step, and now I realize I haven't done the third step. And I'm really up against it. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I can remember, I don't recommend this method of taking the third step, but I'll tell you, this is how I took the third step. As a matter of fact, as you'll tell from my story, I don't recommend you do this the way I did it at all. Any of it. But the third step for sure. So I'm out walking our dog, who I can't stand, it, by the way. And it's about 11 o'clock on a Wednesday night. And it's hot and humid outside, and I'm waiting for the dog to do whatever he is. And we live in an apartment building, so I'm out walking in the parking lot. And I'm over near this smelly big dumpster, because I can remember I'm standing right next to the dumpster, which I suppose there was kind of poetic justice in the fact that I'm standing next to a dumpster. And I'm just absolutely consumed with anger. I mean, all I can feel is anger at God, that I'm stuck. I'm just absolutely stuck. And so I looked up to the sky, and I said, if you're so goddamn good, you take it. And that's how I did the third step. I wasn't kneeling, I wasn't submissive, I was defiant. But it worked. It worked. A couple of days later, I asked God to guide my thoughts and my writing, and I started doing my fourth step. And 6 hours later, I was done with my fourth step. I just wrote for about 6 hours. I followed the directions that my sponsor told me. I wrote down people and the things that I was resentful about. And the really enlightening one was when I wrote down my fears, because I thought I wasn't afraid of anything until I started writing down my fears. And that's how I got through the third and the fourth step. And I was able to make my fifth step meeting. It was an interesting fifth step. My sponsor was definitely guided by God, because he started off by sharing what happened in his fifth step and the things that he was uncomfortable with and afraid of and embarrassed about and resentful about and all that, and made it so that I could share what was my great fears. And the one thing that I've done with anybody I've done a fifth I had to do a fifth step with me, is right away, and this is kind of shock therapy, but he did the same thing with me. Right away, what's the one secret you don't want anybody to know about? What's the one thing that you're going to take to your grave? And once you get that out of the way, it's a piece of cake. It really is a piece of cake. So we went through the fifth step, and it talks about it in the big book. A little bit, and I did experience it. When I walked out from my fifth step, I felt like I could actually float above the ground. I literally, physically felt like the weight of the world had been lifted off my shoulders, and I could almost float above the ground. It was an incredible experience. I haven't had that experience since, but I can certainly remember having it happen then. And about that time, the second miracle, which at the time I thought was the first one, but actually I look back on it, it was the second miracle happened. I realized somewhere along the way that I no longer had the compulsion, the overriding desire to drink. And that was truly a miracle. When I first got in the program, and I can remember this, the first several days, I would be at work, and I would look at, I would think, I got to get a drink. I have got to get a drink. And I'd look at my watch, and I'd say, God, if this doesn't pass in the next 10 minutes, screw it. I'm going to go get a drink. And then I'd look at my watch, and an hour had passed. And the compulsion hit again, and I said, okay, I'll give it 10 more minutes. And then I looked at my watch, and 2 hours had passed. And somewhere along the way, by the time I got through the fifth step, I no longer had the compulsion to drink. And it was so dramatic that I had a wedding to go to. It was my cousin's wedding, and there was no way I could say I'm not going. And I had a wedding to go to. It was about 6 or 8 weeks after I got in the program. And most of the times, like I said, this is not how I would advise people to try and get through the program, but most of the time you would say, yeah, it's probably a little bit dangerous. You may not really want to try that. And I said, yes, I'm going. And nobody at the wedding had any idea that I wasn't drinking, and I wasn't tempted to take a drop all night. It was God had removed it. And as it talks about in the big book, if God has removed it, God has removed it, and you can go wherever you need to be if you have a good reason to be there. And I've seen that in my life over and over again. I can be anywhere as long as I have a good reason to be there. So the 6th and 7th at the time kind of blew by. Okay, because if you read the big book, that's how it says. Okay, you find a nice quiet place. You come to grips with, okay, I don't want that life anymore, which is exactly what I did. I just finished the 5th step. Do I want to live that kind of life anymore? No. Okay, good. Say the 7th step prayer. Away we go. So that's what happened. I've since found that it's a little more complicated than that, and I've had to continually keep working that. But at the time, that was good enough. Now I get to the 8th step. Made a list of all persons we had harmed. Okay. There was some people that were obvious. There were my mom and dad, my brother, my sister, a good friend of mine. That was about it. Fortunately, I had a good sponsor who said, well, what about this person and that person? And like, what about your ex-wife? And what about her? About your ex-in-laws? I didn't do anything to them. What am I going to put them on a list for? No, put them down. Put them down. He said, because there's two parts to the 8th step. There's make a list, and then there's become willing. So I said, okay, fine. I made the list. And I've since learned that I've done a lot more harm than I thought at the time. At the time, I thought, well, you know, I was drunk, and I would throw up in the car, and I would, you know, do stupid shit and stuff like that. And I found since then there was a lot more damage that I had done that I never even dreamed about, but I've learned since then. Anyway, so I make the list. Now you got to become willing. So the first ones were to my parents, and I'll never forget when I told my mother I wanted to come over and say something. She thought it was going to be something horrible, and I just said I was not. Oh, is that all? Oh, okay, that's no problem. And I thought, okay, this is great. So I went around to those people that were close to me, and I made amends, and they all said, oh, I'm so happy to hear you're getting your life together and all that. This is wonderful. That's pretty good. Then I got to make an amends to my in-laws. And it, like it talks in the book, you know, sometimes you're going to run into one of those who's going to tell you you're a complete flaming whatever and we never want to see you again and I hope you shrivel up and die. That was that one. That was that one. And I thought, my sponsor's just an absolute, because he was the one who made me do this. And I needed to hear that, because I needed to be told, hey, this is not a game. This is for real. You've hurt people. You've really hurt people. And in the process of becoming willing and then doing the 9th step for my ex-wife is when I found the next miracle that happened in my life. My wife and I, my first wife and I had gotten divorced since I had gotten in the program. We had kind of got it started before I got in the program, and then got the divorce finished after I went. And as a matter of fact, that's how I looked at, that was the reason I became an alcoholic. Because it had gotten to a point in our marriage where I couldn't stand being home. I could not stand going home to see this woman. And this was in October of a particular year. And remember, I live in Chicago, and I work in downtown Chicago. So it's October, and I can't go. I don't want to go home. And I'm thinking, I can't go stand in Grant Park for 2 or 3 hours till she goes to sleep, because it's cold outside, you know, and it's going to be snowing and all that kind of stuff. So I need to do something. So people would say, why don't you come and have a drink with us after work? And that's how it got started. It started with a drink or two, and it ended when I was staying out until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, going home, taking a shower, and going back to work. So I'm thinking, this woman is the reason I drank. I don't want to make amends to this woman. Actually, to show how childish I was, I had this Victorian image that it was going to be blizzard, it's freezing cold, the wind's blowing, and hot, and in Chicago, this is a common occurrence in the winter, that it was just miserable and nasty and all that. And I'm not joking, this is exactly what I thought. I was hoping that she would come to my door looking for shelter, being in tatters and freezing to death, and I would slam the door in her face and walk away. That's what I thought of this woman. And they told me, well, you got to pray for her. And I thought that was the most ridiculous friggin' thing I had ever heard in my life. I hate this woman. I want to see her rot. And you're telling me I'm supposed to pray for her. Yes. And then he told me, you don't have to mean it. All you have to do is say the words. Oh, okay. I think I can do that. I think I can at least say the words. And that's how it started. They told me to get on my knees in the morning and get on my knees at night and pray for her. Whether you believe it or not, just say the words. And that's how it started. I've heard since that you do that for 2 weeks. I took 6 months. But I did it every day for 6 months. And after 6 months had passed, I was actually able to go and make amends. I was actually able to go and say, I was wrong. I hurt you, and I'm sorry. And I apologize. It was amazing to me, that change. It was absolutely 100% miraculous, because it got to a point where I sincerely really did wish for good things for her in her life, and have since. We've never spoken since I made the amends. I don't know. I do know what happened to her, It proves that if you ask God sincerely, it will happen. Because I heard, actually, there's a little funny anecdote. My wife, my current wife, works with my first wife's sister's best friend. I found that out 35 years later. And what I found out was my first wife had gotten married to a guy, and he invented some kind of software thing. And eventually they got divorced, and she got $9 million in the settlement. And I said, she did a hell of a lot better than sticking around with me. So obviously God listened to my prayers and decided to bless her. I have, and more power to her. I really was happy for her when I heard that. I wish I had been able to share some of it, but that's neither here nor there. There's a part in the big book where it talks about, at some point, we will have no defense against the first drink. And I have firsthand experience with that. Again, they say don't make any major decisions, you know, in your first year. My wife and I, at the time we got married, I had been in the program 6 months. So again, I threw caution to the wind, all the direction, to hell with that, I know better. So we got married. It was interesting. We left the chapel, and on the way to the wedding dinner, we T-boned a car who pulled right in front of us and completely totaled the car. Fortunately, nobody was seriously hurt. My wife and I got kind of banged up. I remember when we got out of the car, my wife said, are you going to need a drink? And I said, no, I haven't even thought about getting a drink. I'd like to get my leg fixed, but other than that, I'm fine. Which was interesting, because we got through the wedding dinner, and we were flying out the next morning to Portland, and we flew out, and that was a really tough flight, because the next morning is when you feel all the bumps and bruises. We got to Portland, and the second night we were there, we went out to a nice fancy dinner. And we're sitting there for dinner, and I asked my wife, do you want wine with dinner? And she said, oh, I don't know. She said, well, I don't really want wine if you're not going to have wine. And I said, I can have a glass of wine. And she said, really? Do you think you should? I said, one glass of wine will be fine. And she said, nah, I don't want wine. And I said, oh, okay. And that was it. I didn't have a glass of wine. But that definitely, in my mind, was God intervening, because all she had to do was say yes, and I would have had that glass of wine. Now, would I have gotten drunk on that glass of wine? I seriously doubt it. I seriously doubt it. But I have no doubt in my mind that if I had been able to have that glass of wine, it would have told me, well, I can have a drink now and then. And that would have been off to the races. Because the truth is, when I drank, I've heard people talk about, you know, triggers. And, you know, you got to stay away from certain things that will trigger your desire to drink. I remember a lady in a meeting a long time ago said, yeah, I had triggers, daylight and nighttime. And I thought, you know, I didn't have triggers. I drank because it was the next day and I drank. And so would I have stopped at a drink? No, I can be honest with myself today. I never wanted a drink. I never wanted a drink. I just wanted to get drunk. I would have times when I would say, I've got some really difficult problem that I need to think about, so I'm going to stop at the bar, have a couple, that'll kind of loosen your mind up, you know, and you'll be able to kind of think through it. And then after six drinks, I couldn't remember what the hell it was I stopped in the bar to think about it all. So that's how my drinking went. So that was definitely God 100% intervening in my life. So that was another miracle, and I've had constant miracles in my life. Let me explain the first miracle that I didn't realize I had had until much, 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 much later. When I look back on it today, I realize I should never have made it in this program. It was truly a miracle from God that I made it in this program, because I am way too smart, way too brilliant, way too tough, way too insightful, way too philosophical, way too religious, all of those way twos to be able to get this program. You know, you cannot be too stupid to get this program, but you can be too smart. And I was way too smart to get this program. How I got into this, and without having a clear picture of how this worked, what the plan was, how everything held together, I had no idea. I had no idea whatsoever. I didn't recognize, you know, it talks about the spiritual plan of action. I had no concept of a plan of action for probably close to the first 20 years I was in this program. I mean, it never dawned on me till, oh yeah, oh, these steps hang together. Oh, that, now I see how this fits. So there was no way I should have been gullible enough and obedient enough and humble enough to follow the directions I got. And yet, God made sure that I was. So then I get to steps 10, 11, and 12. And that's where the rubber really meets the road, because that's when you got to start living this stuff. And there's a couple of things I remember about that. One of the primary things for alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous is to have gratitude. And I remember a meeting I was at. I had been sober, I don't know how long, 15, 20 years. And a guy in the meeting said, you know, I just can't get this gratitude thing. I just can't get this gratitude thing. So after the meeting, I told him, every morning and every night, write out five things to be grateful for, to be grateful God has given you. And if you can't come up with five things to be grateful that God has given you, write down five things to be grateful God hasn't given you yet, like lung cancer or your broken leg or whatever. And I said, if you can't come up with five things to be grateful for or five things to be grateful you haven't gotten, call me. We'll come up with a list in no time. Now, the interesting part of that was I had never thought of that in my life until I was saying it to him. And I thought, that's a good idea. I think I'll start doing that. And I did. And that's when I started my gratitude list. And every morning and every night, I thank God for at least five things that have happened or that haven't happened. And if pressed, if you ask me to spend a few minutes, I can go through a list that will just go on forever, because there's so much God has given me and so much He hasn't given me. The other thing that happened with steps 10 and 11 was a guy was talking about he didn't really understand how to do 10 and 11. And I said, well, it explains it perfectly in the big book. Because if you go to the right pages in the big book, it'll tell you what you're supposed to do at night before you go to bed and what you're supposed to do in the morning. And once again, I had never done that before in my life. And I'm thinking, that's a hell of a good idea. I think I'll try that. So that night, I started. And when I went to bed, I took out the big book and I read exactly what I was supposed to do. And when I got up in the morning, I read exactly what I was supposed to do. And I've been doing that ever since. And it made a huge, huge difference in my life. The other thing that's significant in Alcoholics Anonymous is humility. And I would jokingly say, well, it sounded like I was joking. I was serious, but it sounded like a joke, that I was very proud of my humility. That was one of the things I was most proud of, is how humble I am. And I remember I was sober probably about 22 years, 20 to 22 years. And I was in a meeting, and I was sharing. I had been in this meeting for a while, and there was a woman who was relatively new. She had been around 5 or 6 months. And I was sharing in the meeting. She hadn't seen me because, I've been traveling back and forth from Chicago to other places for a lot of my life. So she hadn't seen me for quite a while. And I was in the meeting, and I shared. And after the meeting, she said, well, how long have you been sober? And I said, well, how long do you think I've been sober? And she said, oh, at least 6 weeks. And I didn't correct her. I said, okay, God, I got the message. I really got the message. And I share sometimes at meetings, I go through phases in my sobriety where there's something that I understand I need to work on. Sometimes it's just trusting God more. Sometimes it's working on being more service. Lately, I've been going through a period where I have to work on my pride and my arrogance. That I finally recognized, geez, I think I'm hot stuff, you know, and that I really got this nailed, and I know what I'm doing. And then God smacks me upside the head and says, no, no, you don't. And that's why I rarely, if ever, share at a meeting how long I've been sober. As I said, I went into my first meeting May 1st, 1978. I haven't picked up a drink since. You can do the math. I don't share that because, quite honestly, I'm embarrassed because I think people look at me and say, that guy's been sober that long and he's still that screwed up? Yeah. And I've come to realize that I'm never going to be that ascended being. Because I had this image when I walked into my first meeting I walked into, there was a guy in the program, his name was Tex Brown. His sponsor's sponsor was Bill W. That's how long he had been in the program. And he had been sober 29 years, and I thought, I'm not 29 years old. This guy's been sober longer than I've been alive. And I thought, you know, when you get to be sober that long, you don't walk on this earth like other people. You float above it. You know, you are impervious to the slings and arrows of normal living. No, nothing can disturb your peacefulness, your zen. And I got to tell you, that ain't the case at all. That don't work for me at all. It just don't. I still run into all kinds of difficulties. But I've learned several things in life, in this life. One of which is, it don't matter how you feel, you just do it. You just do the next right thing. See, I always thought, well, you're supposed to feel God. You're supposed to feel holy and serene. You're supposed to feel at peace, and therefore you're able to do this stuff. And I found most of the time I don't feel that way at all. but I do the stuff I'm supposed to do anyway. And a lot of times, I hate to say it, like I said, a lot of times I tell you, don't do this program the way I did it, because there's easier, softer ways. I will be just cursing God, telling him, you rotten so-and-so, you've done this to me, I hate you, I'm against. And yet, I will immediately turn around and go through my prayers. And it's kind of like praying when I prayed for my ex-wife. I say the prayers sometimes, and I don't mean them at all. And I tell them, I don't mean this, I don't believe in you, but please help me, you son of a... And you know what? God has always come through. It's always worked. So I've realized you always do the next right thing, whether you feel like it or not. And that was tough. I remember, and this was one of my first exposures to it. I was sober, I think I was sober 2 years. And for the first 20 to 25 years, I was angry most of the time. Because when I drank, I was a fun guy. I was not an angry drunk. I was a fun guy. I loved to have good times and all that kind of stuff. I was really mellow when I drank. It was when I stopped drinking that I got really, really angry, because all the anger started coming out. And I remember my wife was sober a couple years. We were in an argument. Probably I started it, because I started most of them. And I remember she said, I liked you better when you drank. And my first thought, of course, was, oh, yeah? Well, I can fix that. And the thought I had at the time was, that's the devil whispering to me. And literally, that's exactly the thought I had was, that's the devil whispering to me, that you're just trying to tempt me into doing it. And I said, I will not pick up a drink. I will not pick up a drink. Now, today, with many more years behind me, I would know that the right thing to do would be to go to a meeting and to talk about it. At the time, I was too arrogant and proud to think about that. I just was going to fight it. And God, having mercy on me, got me through it. Another thing I've learned, and I didn't hear this early in the program, but I've heard it since then, and there's variations on this. So whatever variation works for you, do it. If somebody's giving you this in a different format, great. But there's five things to do every day. Now, the five things, somebody may have told you different five. Here's my five. Here's my five. In the morning, you get on your knees and you ask God to keep you clean and sober that day. You read some AA literature. You talk to another alcoholic. If at all possible, you get to a meeting. And if you hadn't had to pick up a drink that day, at night, you get down on your knees and you ask, you thank God for keeping you clean and sober that day. I do those five things every single day. And when I talk about doing them, whether you feel like it or not, there's a lot of days I didn't feel like doing it. There's a lot of days I didn't feel like thanking God for squat. But I hadn't picked up a drink, so he deserved the thanks. I've told people at times, when I first got in the program, although it was really a bitch, and I that compulsion, and it was just huge. I can look back on it now and in some ways kind of envy people who are early in the program. Because when I was first in the program, life was real simple. There was only two things I had to do every day. Not pick up a drink, not try to kill anybody. If I did those two things, it was a successful day. I still have some of those days. I still have way too many of those days. But I keep doing the right thing, whether I feel like it or not. And as long as I don't pick up a drink, and as long as I don't try and kill anybody, I can say it was a successful day. So that's work. It's getting near 8 o'clock, and I'm not going to go till 8:15, because my voice is going to go before that. So rest easy. As a matter of fact, I'm going to share this. I've often thought, when I go to speak, that it says in How It Works, you tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I thought, it'd be interesting to get up and say, life sucked, I found AA, life is better, good night, have a good night. But then I figured the person who asked me to speak would get really angry with me, so I don't do that. But I'm gonna wrap it up here pretty quickly with the last, and probably, for me, the greatest miracle that's happened in my life happened for me when I was about, I was probably about 15 years sober before I realized it. I'm sure it happened way before that, But that's when I first recognized it. And I can tell you the events. It had nothing, really had nothing to do with alcohol at the time. It was, I thought I was about to lose my job, which shortly after that I did. Because there was, this was the beginning of the year of downsizing and all that kind of crap, and so, and I was afraid it was going to happen. And I was laying there one Sunday morning, and I was thinking, what would happen? And I went through what would happen if I did. And there was this complete feeling of absolute peace. Just absolute peace. And I knew for sure that God had my back. That it was going to be okay. All that was required of me was that I tried to do the next right thing to the best of my ability. And that didn't mean I had to succeed at it. I just had to try the best I could to do the next right thing, and that God would make sure everything would work out okay. And I tell people this. If you haven't experienced that sense of peace, there aren't words to describe it. Because it's not simply a sense of peace. It's an all-encompassing knowing. It is not a material experience. It is a true spiritual experience. If you haven't had that, keep coming back, because I guarantee it will happen. Don't quit before that miracle happens. Now, I mentioned earlier, and I'll finish with this, that my relationship with God has changed dramatically over the years. When I first got in this program, all I thought of God was, I found out later on, was I thought God was basically my father. He was just like my father. He was this guy who punished you. You were never good enough. You step out of line, you're going to get whacked, all that kind of stuff. He was truly the bearded, hairy thunderer from above. And it took a long, long time before that changed. And I remember being in a meeting where it was obviously God speaking to me. This guy who was very learned, he had masters and PhDs in philosophy and law and theology, and I mean just brilliant guy. And he was talking about his understanding of God. And he said, you know, I've given up trying to understand God. Because as a human being, any understanding I have of God would automatically limit God. So I've given up. I just know there's just a God. And that's where my relationship with God is today. As a matter of fact, I'll share this kind of personal view of God. I now have two views of God that happen at the same time. I know it's kind of strange, but I have two views of God. One is this power that enables me to do what I need to do and that has my back. And that's kind of the Michael the Archangel, the Lord of all. And then I have this other vision, and this has taken me over 30 years in the program to get. And it's really, and I'm going to expose a little bit of my thinking here, this is really the female, the nurturing, the loving, the caring, the helpful. And I have both of those views of God. And I couldn't tell you what God looked like. I couldn't. If I had to give you a definition of God, the only definition I can give you, and this is truly a higher power, is love. So if you walk into these rooms and you say, well, I don't believe in God and all that kind of stuff, think of love. I was watching, and just to show you how screwed up I get, I've been having a lot of back problems lately and a lot of back pain. And to share you how God has had my back for so many years, in October of 2010, I had my left knee replaced because I had a cyst in the bone and it was about to explode. In March of 2011, I had my right shoulder replaced. In October of 2012, I had double bypass surgery. I didn't have a heart attack. They caught it before I had a heart attack. It's another miracle. Then in July of 2014, I had my right knee replaced. And then in August of 2014, I had my left shoulder replaced. And then in March of 2015, I had my right shoulder re-replaced because it wasn't working right. And then in August of 2015, I had my left shoulder replaced because the replacement had broken. So I had 7 surgeries in 4.5 years. And God had my back through all of those. And I went through every one of those with no fear whatsoever, because I knew God had my back. And yet, this past Wednesday, I'm cursing God because my back hurts, and I'm thinking, I don't believe in you, to hell with you, I don't need you anymore. I don't even believe in you. I don't know why I'm talking to you, because you're not even there. And I'm not joking, that's exactly what went through my mind. And then the next day I said, okay, look, God, I have to speak Sunday night. And right now I want to tell people you don't even exist. So if you want me to do any kind of job, you're going to have to do something quicker. Otherwise, this is going to be an absolute disaster. This is going to be a train wreck. And here I am tonight. My last words. God speaks to me through all kinds of mechanisms, mostly you people, but sometimes in the strangest places. Absolutely the strangest places. This is my last comment. Last night I'm watching The Count of Monte Cristo. And I don't know if you know the story, but I'm not going to go through the whole story. But I'm watching this, and there's one point in the meeting where Edmond Dumas, who's the guy who got locked away unjustly for 15 years, 13 years, whatever, he's about to try and escape. And the guy who helped him says, well, may God be with you. And he said, I don't believe in God. And the guy said, don't worry, he believes in you. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you for listening.